For those of you who haven't been here before, welcome. This is the Simple Actions Group. We meet every Monday night at this time at 7 o'clock in this room. Normally, we're a 12-step study. We have a panel of speakers, and we go through each step one by one through the week. It takes about 13 weeks for us to go through the 12 steps, and then at the end of that 13th week, we have an event like this called Supper and a Speaker, where we have a potluck at 6, and then we have a special speaker come in and share. So thank you. Welcome if you're new. And please come back next week. We'll be starting back on step one. The volume needs to go up. That's too bad because it's maxed out. So we'll have to speak much closer to this. Okay. Good evening. I'd like to welcome everybody to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is David and I'm an alcoholic. For those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms across the hall exclusively. At this time, please silence your cell phones, which I have not done. And then I'll forget if I don't do it right now. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. I will now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So I explained what the format normally is tonight. Also, I don't want to forget to thank every single one of you that came and brought something to eat and something to share. And a potluck is kind of a spiritual adventure in the first place. You really never know what you're going to get. And so the invitation goes out and everyone seems to rally. And I think there was plenty of everything for everybody, but my perceiver may be wrong. I hope everybody got enough. So tonight we have a very special speaker. Jim is one of the fellows around here that I look up to. I'm one of my heroes, and we're just very. I'm not going to take up any more of his time. I'm very grateful to have Jim W. from the Principals Group.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jim Willis, and I am an alcoholic. Sobriety date, August 23rd, 1982. I'm a member of the Principals Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Chesapeake. We're a closed discussion group that's based on the literature, topic-driven. First Tuesday of the month, we study and discuss a topic from the big book. The second is we can pick any other AA-approved literature from the second and the third week. The fourth week, we study and discuss the tradition for that month. And if there is a fifth Tuesday of the month, we study and also discuss our history. And that's on Tuesday nights at 8 o'clock we start. We'd love to have any of you want to come out that way. And believe it or not, the road runs both ways, north of Chesapeake and Chesapeake back. So it's you go in and get out pretty quick. I want to put a disclaimer out here right quick. For those of you who saw the first flyer, Tom Iveser was to be here to speak. And I'd be remiss if I didn't say this. Tom is my sponsor. And I was really looking forward to hearing Tom talk tonight, just as much as anyone in this crowd. And I do know Tom well enough to know that for him not to be here, there has to be a health problem. Man's 81 years old, and he runs wide open all the time, carrying a message to the drunks. And he often says that's how I wish when he goes out of here, he hopes it's whenever he's on a 12-step call to another drunk trying to help him. And knowing Tom, that's most likely to happen. I'm not here to fill in for Tom or speak for Tom. That's my disclaimer. Nor if anyone reports back to him about how it went, I'm not taking credit for that either. And especially if it goes by via the pipeline of my own sponsor. And when I say that, you know, there's never a time that I get up to tell my story that I don't get nervous. But tonight I'm even more nervous than usual. But that's probably okay. You know, for whatever reasons, I know David asked me some time ago, he said, well, Tom's going to come up, and he says, could you, just in case something will come up where Tom couldn't make it up, he said, would you be, his backup? So I kind of laughed, and I said, well, that's not a problem, sure. I says, Tom, don't miss no events. I said, I'll begin to sit in the audience. So when I got the little email 2 nights ago, I was as shocked as all of you were when you saw the second flyer go out. So clearing that out, I'm going to go ahead and launch off into this thing. And I do want to read this. It helps me to remind what I'm up here for. And it's in the 5th chapter of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And basically it says this. Our stories disclose, in a general way, what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. The key word here is general. I'm not going to stand up here and do a fist step with anyone. I've done that with a sponsor, and that was tough enough. But I am going to go off on this, and bear with me for a couple minutes here until the nervousness subsides and move in. So I'm going to start at the beginning. I was born in the great state of Kansas, 1948. So you don't have to sit there and figure out that, or some of you quick ones, I'm 66 years old. So you can just put that thing to the side and move on. And so now it's perfectly okay. One of the guys over here, he says, "Why did I get a good chair for taking a nap?" I said, "I think you did." I says, "As a matter of fact, I said, you could leave now and just avoid the nap altogether if you'd like." But say that, you know, I was born in state, and this isn't going to be a story about my dad, but first drink I ever had was given to me by my dad. So some of that comes in, but we were 6 kids and mom and dad, and we were poor. I used to say we were poor, but we were beyond poor. I mean, so poor that we didn't have sense enough to know we were poor. I mean, it was rough. But and it was never because dad didn't get a good job. Dad would get good jobs. He'd work for the Santa Fe Railroad. He'd drive 18-wheelers out across the West there and make good money. But dad also liked to drink. And he also liked to get in a few fights. And when you put the two combinations together, it's hard for the man to keep a good job. I think he always thought he should have been the boss. But I remember as a kid growing up, there was a part of me that loved my dad, but there was also a part that feared the man, because he could, whether he was drinking or not, he'd get pretty mean. And out of the 6 of us kids, the 2 older kids, older sister and older brother, they moved out of the house when they got up to about 16. But the other 4 of us were still out there on that farm, and I remember always thinking about whenever mom and dad would get in a fight and get to arguing, and I always knew that my dad would take off and go to one of them old honky-tonks. He used to go to a place, you know, called Caroline's Tavern. And it was rough. Him and some of his brothers would meet down there, and they'd be just drinking and fighting and listening to the old Hank Williams. I mean, the real Hank Williams. I mean, that stuff be, you know, the Lonesome Cattle, you name it. He had it all. And Dad had wailed us up, and Dad sang pretty good. But nobody wanted, even back those days, I mean, a nickel, you could get two or three songs. But no one wanted to hear Dad sing Hank Williams, especially if they just played, the, you know, their nickel in there to hear it. Dad had a sense he had to entertain them. And there'd always be some kind of fight. But I remember all the time he'd head off there, have him and Mom's already, I'd beg him to go with him. Sometimes he'd let me go and sometimes he wouldn't. And I tell that story because for many, many years, the only connection my dad and I ever had was our alcoholism and drinking. That was it. There was not much else there. And I'm not blaming him. It's just the way it worked out. You know, he had his own rough spell that he could tell his own story if he was still alive here tonight. But I remember going with him the first time and they ever had a drink. It was over at an uncle's house and I was a little fat kid. Well, put it this way. Dad always said, he says, of those six kids, he's the only one I know that gets sick, and he's really sick as that boy there because he don't come to the supper table. He's eating me out of house and home. Well, I did take on some pretty heavy stores, you know, coming up. Never know when he'd take off again and when we might need some. So, you know, I already had a justification for what I did, but I can remember we go into, and him and my uncle were out drinking, and I was out running around in the field. I come back, and I must have been about 7, 8 years old, and I was thirsty. And I asked my dad, I said, can I have a drink, thinking to be water? And they were drinking these little country club malt liquor cans, little things. And they were ice cold. They had them in a big cooler. They were ice somehow. And he gave me three of those things. I drank them and took off running. And I think I passed out under the only tree in Kansas. Because of all them tornadoes. But I can remember laying up underneath that tree and everything circling and thinking to myself, I'm out of here. And just bam, I was gone. So when he carried me back, you know, later we went to a honky-tonk, and later when he carried me back home on the farm, him and Mom got to fight about him bringing me in all drunked up like that. But I loved it. And again, because it put me with him. And what I didn't realize is that just sort of set the tone. No, I didn't become an alcoholic at 8 years old. I'm not going to say that. But at 11 years old, Mom and Dad got divorced, and it was because Dad's drinking, and she, after 21 years, she just couldn't take anymore because through his drinking. And I can remember many times people would come and take all the furniture out of our house, or we'd hide because the bill collectors would be there, wouldn't have much food. That was just the way we lived. I mean, it was just a way of life. And so when Mom and Dad got divorced again, I was glad to see him go. But I loved him and I missed him, but I was also, I wasn't afraid anymore at night when he left. And so I didn't get much drinking on during those time years. And as the years moved on, I'm going to move through some of this a little quicker. As the years moved on, I began to get somewhat larger. And, large enough that when I finally got to high school, I weighed about 240 pounds. And it was not football conditioning. I can certainly tell you that. Because when I moved, it all moved. And Now, I can tell you there in that high school, I looked at the girls. There was no doubt I already had an infatuation for the girls. But the problem is, when you're weighing about 240 pounds and that stuff moves and you're poor and you don't have much anyway, I wasn't about to ask one of those girls out. I already knew what the answer would be, and I thought I can shame myself. I don't need this girl to shame me. And so I just sort of kept my distance. And finally, I just quit high school. At 16, I said I had enough, and it was in February of 1965. I went to work for an uncle of mine owned a moving storage company. I don't think the man had a dolly in the world. If he did, he didn't let us use it. And it was February, it was snowing, and the first day to go to work for him, he looked at me, and I never forgot his words. He says, "Fat boys, I'm going to work it off of you." Well, that was February. Come May, I was down to 185 pounds. And it no longer moved. And but the one thing that did happen, nothing changed inside. I was still fearful. I was terrified. It didn't make any difference what I saw in the mirror. I just didn't fit in. I'd always been one of those kids from the beginning. And so when the book talks about being restless, irritable, and discontent, I knew that long before I started experiencing or I read it in that book. Somehow I never felt like I fit in, no matter who it was. But this uncle introduced me to alcohol again. And they'd have these things where on Saturday, he only hired two types of folks. He'd hire us guys that quit high school and couldn't get a job anywhere else. And then he would also hire the guys down off Skid Row. So as young guys would drive the trucks, we'd go down on Skid Row with an extra $20 bill to bring one of those old boys with us to help move furniture that day, pay them their 20 bucks, but he told us don't give it to them until the end of the day because they'll walk on you. So that was the thing, don't walk, because if you do and he walks on you, you're going to pay him my $20 back. So, but anyway, that's the way, and they had this thing set up, and everybody in our family was kind of, they knew what everybody else's business was. I don't know if that's unique to Kansas, but I know there in that small town, everybody knew who was what, and there was a tradition among my dad and his brothers and stuff is us boys needed to be tough. And so I can remember going to work there drinking a little bit, and every Saturday night they'd have, the older guys would buy the booze for us, and we'd go out behind that warehouse and we'd get drinking, and then we'd get to fight. Now the worst thing could happen to you if you lost the fight, because it was going to be all out across everybody. So, and me and my brother talked about this a few years ago. I said, Sonny, I said, remember when Dad used to always tell us that if you walk away from a fight, you're going to wish you stood your ground when you come home, or you're going to get a worse beating here? He says, yeah. I said, you ever regret any of that? He says, more than once. He says, and he's smaller than me. He says, many a time, he said, I stood my ground when he said, I knew going in, I didn't even have a fighting chance. He said, but I stood my ground. And that was kind of the way it was taught. Well, at 17, when I turned 17, I wanted to leave, and I wanted my mom to sign for me to go in the military, and at first she just wouldn't do it. And I was down to about 185 then, so I knew I could get in, 1965, and I finally worried her to death that she signed the papers. I tell that to say this, is that when we were leaving out of Kansas City at the old Union Station, we got down there, and we were all getting on a train. It was going to be a 2 or 3 day train trip out to San Diego to go on a boot camp with the Navy. And now I can tell you, I told my brother, I said, he asked me, he says, why did you end up in the Navy? He says, everybody else always went in the Army, including him. I said, well, Sonny, I said, I'm not real bright, but I said, I can tell you this. I said, I went down there to that recruiting station and they had the Army recruiters thing there. And all I could think of is, I don't know how to do anything but dig a ditch. I said, I'll be digging latrines for the rest of my life in that Army. I said, I ain't doing that. I said, then next that they had one of these big old posters that showed a young sailor in a foreign port standing out in front of some big Navy gray ship. And we didn't see many ships in Kansas. They just didn't sail in there often. But that young guy had that Dixie cup cocked back on one thing, had them bell bottoms on, and that was part of it. Then I said, he had a good-looking woman on either arm. I said, that's the one for me. And I turned and went into the Navy, and that's how I made my decision. He said, I wish I'd have seen that poster. I said, you're the oldest. That don't mean you're the brightest. And so we laugh and joke about that today, but I did. I stand on that old Union Station, And I remember even the guy that went in with me on a buddy plan. In those days, you went in as buddies, you'd both be in the same company during boot camp, but then after that, there weren't any guarantees you'd be sent to different places. Ray and his family were there, my mom, and everybody around there waiting, a bunch of young guys getting on train. Everybody was crying, or at least from what I could see. I looked around, and it made me really uncomfortable. And I remember a thought is as clear tonight as it was then that entered my head, when I get on that train, I'm not coming back. I didn't cry. All I wanted to do was I wanted to leave. Didn't know where I was going to end up. Didn't know where I was going to. I just knew something was driving me. I had to go. And I don't, to this day, I wasn't treated any worse than any of us six kids. But something in me was leading me, and I didn't have a clue, but I was leaving. And it ended up being that way. Out of six kids, I was the only one that didn't stay in Kansas. Even my brother, he come back after being in the Army for a few years and stayed there. But I remember going out there, and of course I wasn't either bright enough or I wasn't really willing to take a risk any drinking in boot camp. But I come back, and after boot camp, what happened was most of the guys got orders to ships. I didn't get a ship. I got one of these little torpedo stations up in outside of Bremen and Washington riding torpedo retrievers and target boats. And in my mind, I'm thinking, I'm not even good enough to get a ship. They send me this little tunky boat up there, so when I come back on leave, I go to a high school football game, and I go in there, and these girls that I'd always admired from afar, they didn't know who I was, and we were sitting behind them, and this one, I think every guy thinks that every girl, there's always one that's a cheerleader that's more gorgeous than anybody else. I don't know about all that, but, you know, that's what I was thinking. But we got to talking. I brought me in about a half a pint of liquor, and I'm drinking at that football game and got that uniform on. And they might see Marines on occasion or Army there, but they just didn't see sailors in Kansas. And so I was, you know, sticking out from that. So anyway, I got liquored up a little bit where I could talk and talking with these girls. And one of them says, "Jim, oh my God." You know, I'm thinking, yeah. So the football game gets over, we're walking off the field, and they've thrown all these streamers on the field after the team had won. And so me and my buddies are walking off, and we're in front of these girls, and all of a sudden, the one I've been talking to calls my name. She says, "Jim," and that sounds just like an angel or something. Of course, now that old Jim Beam has started working a little bit too, so I mean, you know, and but in my mind, I'm like, yeah, she wants me. You know, I mean, I can see it already, so I'm strutting even more. And I turn around, and she says, "You got something on your foot." And I looked down on my foot, and I had stepped in the only dog pile, probably in a 10-mile radius, and I had about 15-foot of streamer run along behind me. And I'm trying to get it off, you know, and that dog stuff is up the back of those blues, and so I'm trying to get off. Everybody's laughing, including the girls, and I laughed about it. I tell that story partially to tell this. I knew the answer already at 17. I immediately went out and got drunk. See, I didn't know how to handle it. I was humiliated, ashamed, but I couldn't take that. But I already knew what my answer was, and that solution became my solution for many years after that. I couldn't handle living in the same world that everyone else lived in. Somehow I didn't fit. And I knew that, drinking or not. But once I got drinking, at least I had a 50-50 chance on the deal. And that became the way of life. Well, I got those orders. A year later, I get to almost all of us guys coming out of that little small station got orders to Vietnam riding gunboats. Now, we weren't smart enough to know that's what they'd had us up there for a year training us for. We just thought, you know, we'd made out. And, you know, we'd go to Seattle on the weekend and drink and party and stuff and had girlfriends. And so, man, this is great. And we saw the ship, but we didn't have to get on them. And, but they righted the ship, so to speak, a year later when they sent us all to Vietnam. I was always known just to leave, you know, all kinds of situations, never saying goodbye. No matter who it was, I would just leave. And so I come back after going through training. I was going through training for Vietnam, and so we went through the survival training and all this stuff. But I went home for a couple of weeks, and I told my mom, I said, "Well, I'm not going for a while. We still got other training and this and that." Well, I got shipped out not long after that to Vietnam, and I was in country 3 months riding those gunboats up and down rivers and along the coastline, and my mom still didn't know I was out of the country. And my division commander calls me down one day, and I won't use the words here, but he called me a lot of wonderful names, and I didn't get any special medals either, I can tell you, about what a lowlife I was, that they got a thing from the Red Cross. My mother was looking for me. She was in a panic. And so every day for a long time, I had to write a letter and send it back every day and show him that letter that it was leaving. I look back on that, my mom was just a good woman. I was just one of her six kids, but I can only imagine what it must have been like for her, not knowing where I was at, knowing that I was going to be going to Vietnam, but not having any idea when or any of that, and just leaving, and no thought about that. I'll tell you, when I went into Vietnam, if I wasn't a drunk when I went in, you can guarantee I was full-fledged when I rolled back out of there a year later. I've often told folks, I said, you know, maybe they're just braver men than me, but I saw combat. I was there during the worst Tet Offensive, so I know what it is to be fired at and a steady stream of red coming in at you. I mean, so I understand that. And I used to tell people, I said, anyone tells me they were never afraid with incoming rounds is either a liar or they're nuts. I said, it's one or the other, that when you see that, I mean, just the instinct. Well, I drank. So, when I drank, I could be just as bad as anybody else and do just as crazy as stuff. And that, again, it was my solution to the fear and having to deal with what was going on. I spent that year there, and there was more than one thing. I got in trouble there a lot. You know, it's not good being in the military, and then when you get to drinking, always bucking the authority, because I was always junior. And so, you know, and people don't, you know, when you're getting, you're an E3 and you're getting fights with E5s all the time, it's not a good thing. And so I was routinely getting in trouble. But one night, me and another guy stole the division commander jeep, and we figured we had a right to do that. We were over there, we hadn't been able to drive for the whole time we'd been over there, and all we was going to do is drive it up and down on the road there a little bit and then take it back. Well, that worked pretty good while I was driving, but when my buddy, he got on it, he blew the engine. And so I jumped out of the jeep and run back up to the old Quonset hut we lived in. And I'm in my Quonset hut thinking to myself, man, you are slick. Ain't nobody ever going to know that you were involved with this. And old Young, about 45 minutes later, he shows up. And I said, man, what took you so long? He said, they caught me. I said, why didn't you hide? He said, I did. I said, where? He's under the jeep. I said, oh, man, I said, you dummy. I said, you deserve. He said, well, they asked me if anybody's with me. I told him, yeah, Willis. And I'm thinking, man, I'm really shafted, because I've stood before this commander before, and he wasn't real pleased to ever see me. And the next morning, everybody's looking at that. That jeep is there, and it's got oil out from underneath it. It's not moving anywhere. I went right on down the boat and lit the engines off, and generator and boat officer come in, and I said, sir, I says, you always told me if anything happened, you want to be the first to know it. You didn't want to hear it through the grapevine or anything. He looked at me, and he was used to me getting in trouble. He said, Willis, what have you done this time? So I told him, and he started laughing. He said, I'm just glad it was somebody off my crew that got that big Swede. Our commander was a Swede. And he said, I'll tell you what we're going to do, Willis. He said, I'm going to tell him I had you down here overnight doing maintenance on the engines, getting things ready to go out on patrol today. He said, that work for you? I said, it does for me, yeah. You know, I'm not real bright, but I'm not the dimmest bulb either. I knew what was the way out. And but after that, I got in trouble again, and this commander kept me in his office after everybody else had left and closed the door. He said, Willis, he said, I'm going to tell you what. If you'll get honest about stealing my jeep and the damage you caused, he said, I'll dismiss these charges you're up for. So I did what I always did. A lie just, my mouth opened, a lie fell out, and I was, sir, I don't know what you're talking about. And his head looked like it swelled up like a pumpkin, got all red and everything, and told me he'd send me out his knee zero. Fortunately for me, he got transferred in a couple weeks, and I was standing for the other one because it was a routine. And but I didn't make the year, and I come home, and I took 30 days leave. And this father I told you about, that there was no doubt Dad was an alcoholic. Within just a few days of me being back in country, he told me, he said, boy, you got a problem, talking about my drinking. And I was only 19, and I looked at him, and I said, if anyone's got the problem, you got the problem. I said, don't lay this off on me. But I already was having a lot of problems. See, the book talks about the lack of control. I could no longer control my drinking when I picked up a drink. I could tell you what I was going to do. I was going to live up to whatever it was I told you I was going to do, and I wanted to do that. But as my illness began to progress, it just didn't happen. In just about a week's time, coming back from Vietnam, I bought a new car on a Tuesday. No, I got back on a Tuesday. I bought the car on a Wednesday. Went to Wichita, Kansas for a family reunion. Before that weekend was out, was in a location I shouldn't have been in and had a shotgun put in my face. I ran that new car into the side of a bridge after I'd met a girl that was a go-go dancer, and I thought, boy, I've done died and went to heaven here. And the next week in Kansas City, Missouri, I had a gun put in my face again, and a week or so after that, me and some of my buddies chased some Missouri boys back across the line, and they didn't play fair. They had guns, and we didn't. And shot holes through the hood of my car and into the firewall, and I was so drunk I didn't know it until the next day my brother-in-law saw it. Now, this is just about a week and a half after coming out of combat zone and not getting hit, and come back in just a matter of just a few days, I'm just nuts, just wide crazy. I'm going to go back just for a moment, because this was really important while I was in Vietnam. And December 23rd, 1967, we'd come in off patrol, and I'd never had more than a day or so off patrol. And I was going to be off for 3 days and wasn't going to have to go out again until Christmas morning. And So I just couldn't believe it. But anyway, that night we got hit, our base did. And the first time when they hit us, what they did, they infiltrated the other end of the base. And the second time they called general quarters, VC were waiting right outside our huts. And a good friend of mine, his name was Carl Goodfellow. Carl was a second class and was like a big brother to me. And I was a fireman. And I remember I was in front of him and I said, man, this would be another false alarm. I'm going back to my bunk, grab my cigarettes and lighter. And he's all right. He said, I'll see you in the bunker. So I went back, he went out, and they were outside, and they shot him 3 times in the chest, and he died. I say that because for many, many years, I denied that ever really happened. I thought maybe I had just made that story up until many years later, 20-some years later, after I come back, I finally went to the wall, and I saw his name. And I could never, I remember touching that wall, seeing his name, seeing the date. And it was just like everything come tumbling all in again. It was as if walking back into that night. But for years, I really did. I convinced myself I had made that story up. It didn't exist. When I come back, and that was just, there was one thing after another. And the drinking got worse. I got to New York City. I got on an old destroyer, and that's where I met my wife. And had she known what she was fixing to go out with and dance with and eventually marry, she'd have probably turned that first dance down. But she didn't know any better. She'd been raised in a family where her father was alcoholic and she was the oldest of 4 children, so she knew how to handle drunks. And someone told us many years later after I got sober, says it was just like a hand in a glove, you know? He looked at my wife and the counselor looked at my wife and says, you know, you were looking for a drunk to save. He was just like, and I'm thinking to myself, that's a getter, you know? And he looks over at me with my smirk on my face, and he says, and you need somebody to rescue and pull you out of everything as a drunk. And which was pretty close. She was from New York City and I was from Kansas, and it's, the cultures weren't necessarily compatible for a lot of reasons. But what happened was is that we got a year later, got out of the Navy. My last night in the Navy, in my first 4 years, they gave me duty for some problems I got into alcohol related. And they gave me a choice. We're either going to put you on 30-day legal hold and then take you to the captain, or you're going to stand duty your last night in the Navy and miss the big ship's party, which my wife had already bought a nice dress and all that stuff to go to the ship party, and I had to stay aboard a ship. So it didn't get better from that either. But we did get married, and I eventually was out of the Navy and decided to go back in. I told my wife I'm going back in the Navy because I says, these folks in around here, if I stay around my family, I'm going to turn into a drunk. Well, I already was one. I mean, you know, but somehow in my mind, I thought I was going to get, you know, like them. And most of them were better off than I was, quite frankly. But she says, what are you going to do? She says, you hated the Navy. I thought it'll be different this time. Well, they talk about those geographical cures, so I was just going to go back in and get out of Kansas. That's all I was looking for. We got married, and we were stationed down in Charleston, South Carolina, and we were newlyweds, and the first little place we had was a little $55 a month trailer. This was in 1969. And because of that, I can tell you what, there was about as much in that trailer then as you would see in a $55 a month trailer now. There wasn't a whole lot in there. And I was third class, and just moving right up the pecking order, you know, I was already third. And but I went out, and my wife became pregnant with our first child, our daughter, and I went out and got drunk on one of the nights, on payday night, and I come in about 9 o'clock in the night. Now, I have gained a lot of weight back, and by now, I'm about 265, and the Navy had let you grow beard, so I had a big black beard, and my wife's about 5-6 months pregnant, and I come into that trailer smoking a big cigar somebody had given me, and I looked at her, and I said, you stick with me, babe, we're going places. You know? She told me, she said, I thought of a lot of places where that cigar could go. And she said, if I hadn't been as pregnant as I was and you hadn't been as big as you was, I may have made the attempt to. But when our daughter was born, my wife had to go back with the family because I was changing shifts. And the night she went in to deliver with our daughter, it took me a while to get on, you know, to get up there. I did get there before my daughter was born, but all I could think of, my alcoholism had already progressed to the point that all I could think of is I knew there'd be a big party. My wife's family were Norwegian, Irish, and Italian. Oh. And they, I knew there'd be, and she'd be in the hospital where she couldn't tell me not to drink. So I thought, man, this is great. That's all I could think of. But I did do the right thing. I was there when our daughter was born. But then all bets were off. And I always promised her that if we ever had another child, that would be different. One of the things that, happened, too, is that after our daughter was born, we spent a couple years in Charleston. We got sent to Spain. And right before she came in, I'd been in a head-on collision with another vehicle. Me and some of my buddies had been outside of Rota drinking. On the way back in, we crashed into another Spanish couple. And I can remember all the glass breaking, being thrown from the car, and everything being in slow motion, and landing on my back and sliding across the asphalt into the ditch. And I remember the first thought that came to me is, thank God I'm still alive. When everything kind of slowed down, I could hear the screaming. The other carloads of sailors behind us were locking their brakes up not to run into us. And it was crazy. And I walked up to the car where the Spanish couple were in. The Spanish woman was screaming hysterically, and blood was all over her face. And her husband was bent over the steering wheel and didn't look like he was breathing at all. And even as drunk as I was, I thought, this is the end of the deal. But the insanity of this is they come in, they got the shore patrol, everybody got us back. And fortunately, neither the couple passed away or anything. They made it. They did survive. But they took all of us sailors, and we couldn't find the guy that had been driving the car that I was in. Nobody could locate him. They take us back to the hospital and bandage us up, and I've got messed up ribs and stuff, so they're bandaging. And the insanity is after they bandaged up, we went back out in town and started drinking again. Now, this is the insanity. Now, I'm only about 23 years old at this time, 24, and I was already crazy. I mean, and could not see it. So when my wife and daughter arrived in country, first thing she looks, she says, you've wrecked our car, haven't you? No, it wasn't mine, it was the other guy's. You know, I said, our car is still in good shape. But the insanity just kept on. I'm going to fast forward just a little bit. 5 years after our daughter was born, our son was born. And I began to collect DUIs like Christmas tree ornaments, you know. And I really got to the point that I thought people were calling ahead and telling them I'd come into town. My first night in Norfolk, Virginia, back in the 80s, they locked me up. And I just knew them people in South Carolina had called ahead, because I'd hit every jail down around Charleston at one time or another. They'd locked me up, and I just knew they'd called ahead on me. And yeah, I was that important. And but when our son was born, I always told my wife, I always had good intentions. I wanted to be a good husband, I wanted to be a good father, but my drinking never allowed it. And consequently, what happened was the night that she went into labor with our son, I was drunk and passed out, and they had to get the neighbors to take her to the hospital. I got to the hospital the next morning right before she gave birth to our son, and I remember the nurse that let me come in, I said, I'm looking for my wife, and she could just look at me and tell me I was a town drunk, you know, and she says, you must be Mr. Willis. Well, that just irked me even more. I thought, well, you go so-and-so, you know, just let me in there, you know. I said, yeah, I'm Mr. Willis. You want to see my ID card? And she said, no, I can recognize you or something like that. But anyway, I get in there, and so we have our son, and a few years later, we get stationed in Morocco. Same thing. That when I got the orders to go to Morocco, before you could go and take a dependent, you had to go through screenings and make sure you didn't have an alcohol problem back in those days. And this was in the 70s. And not only did I have an alcohol problem, but my wife had left me again with our two children to go home to her family because of my drinking. That's all it was. And I begged her to come back and be different. We got to Africa. It was the same deal. You all know the drill. That went on. I had to send her back early. Because of my drinking, she and my two children went back. I just went crazy even after that. Fell down a flight of steps, cut off the top of my ear. I'm working in an engine power plant. Next morning, guys say, man, your ear's ready to fall off. I said, oh, man, it's good. And these engines are just throbbing and everything. So finally, I was starting to feel a little dizzy, and I thought, well, just probably some of that booze ain't worked off yet. So I go into the bathroom, and they were right, man. That thing was flopping in the breeze. There wasn't much left on there. So I went up there, and The doctor, he looked at me and said, how did that happen? I said, Doc, you're never going to believe this. I said, you know, I'm on call 24-7 down at that power plant. I said, well, I got a call about 4:30 this morning. I said, they were having problems keeping power online. I said, I was in the shower. I come out, fell down that flight of steps trying to hurry up and get my clothes on to get to the power plant. And he looked at me almost in disbelief, and he said, right. And he said, well, I'm going to sew it back on, but he said, I'm not going to guarantee you a matching set. And, but he did a pretty good job, you know, and this was all after my wife had left. But what happened was when I finally come back, and we agreed that we'd stay together then, first question I come through customs, my wife asked me, she's, how's your ear? Now, I knew I had never been stupid enough to tell her about that. So now I'm really scared. I thought, what else does she know? And so I lived in terror. If whatever it was she knew, she kept to herself for a long time. But I think that was her out saying, okay, quit, sucker. I got enough on you, you know. But to come back and moving this forward, we got stationed in Norfolk. It was getting crazier. And I got my last DUI, which was, I guess, April of 1982. And by this time, I'd walked away from my wife and two children for no other reason. I was chief by then, and I was going to drink when I wanted to. Nobody was going to tell me otherwise, and I just walked away from them. My family from Kansas were willing to come out and move my wife and our two children back to Kansas and get them a home and get them situated. And she wouldn't leave. She said, I can't leave him. What I can say is that same woman at that time had every reason in the world, every right in the world to leave, didn't, and come June we'll celebrate 45 years of marriage. That's, believe me, I wish she was here because she deserves a lot more credit than I do. I can tell you that, a whole lot more credit. And some of the folks in here tonight know my wife, and I often tell them, I says, my wife instinctively knows how to forgive. I don't know how that happens. I don't. It's something I still struggle with today, even after all these 24 hours. But she, I watch her sometimes in the way that she, how she lives a spiritual life in her own way, and it still kind of throws me out. I don't know quite how she come up with that. They asked one of our grandchildren one time, describe your grandmother in one word. He said, can I use two? And they said, okay. They said, what is it? And she says, loving and forgiving. I said, oh, that's pretty good. Then they asked him, well, what about your grandpa? I said, oh, here it comes. He says, determined. You know, I said, hey, buddy. I said, you tell grandma she's loving and forgiving, you give me determined? He said, no, grandpa. And this was after I'd been sober a long time. But what he said was, he says, you don't surrender easy, grandpa. Well, look at us. You know, there's some truth in that somewhere. Back there that we don't surrender easy. But when I got that last DUI, I got a nudge from the judge to go into the Navy's alcohol rehab center. And this was back in 1982 when they used to call it the ARC. And they used to put us on these white vans and send us around. But those were anonymous vans, you know. They had a white van and a big black number on it. Number 1, 2, 3. And everybody knew what those vans were for. You know, you could go out there and... oh, there go the drunks again. You know, that's you know. But we were supposed, okay, we're anonymous out here. Yeah, we were anonymous, all right. But what happened there was, it was a good program. But what more importantly, they introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's when things began to change. They got my wife in there, and our family started putting back together. I got a sponsor. I got a home group, and I got into service work in my home group. Not because I just volunteered, but because my sponsor at that time came in, and I was complaining about the coffee wasn't done on time. And he said, this really bothers you, doesn't it? I said, well, I'm just ashamed. You know, I says, Eddie, that you come to my home group and they don't have it. And he says, it's really bothering you, isn't it? And I still didn't see it coming. I says, yeah, I says, I'm really sorry that the folks didn't have it ready on time. He said, won't you get off your so-and-so and you make it? So before I had it smart enough, I said, okay, I will. Well, then I got there every week. He wasn't a member of that group, but I always got there early and made sure it was good because I prayed he'd sneak in on me and it wouldn't be done and I'd be confronted with that. But that man was the right guy to be my sponsor at that time. He began to walk me through these steps. And one through three. And then when I got to four, I'd been sober about 9 months. And I got sent down to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba for several weeks. And I thought, that's just what I need. Going down there as a drunk, recovering drunk, where you can drink anything. I'm going to be down there all these weeks. And I said, oh, God. So he told me, he said, now's the time for you to work on that fifth step. And get on with it. And or finish the four step. That's what he said. So I did. And when I was pretty close, and when I got back, he said, how are you doing? I said, well, I said, I don't like what I got on the paper. I was trying to do a thorough moral inventory, the best I could. And I was trying to put all that down on paper. And the more I read it, the more it made me kind of sick. Because I would pray, and I would, like they suggested, and I would follow what I'd been told. But the more I wrote, the sicker it. And I thought, I can't do this. You know, in my mind, I was thinking that. And I told him, I said, Eddie, he says, are you finished yet? I said, no, man. I told him what was going on. He said, get on with it and finish the thing before you drink behind it. He said, just finish the thing. Because, see, I knew what would come after four. I could still count. And that was five. And that meant I'd have to talk to one of you straight up, face to face. Well, that was a whole different proposition. But I remember the day I went to Eddie's house to do that fifth step. And it's, for me, it's not always this way. So I don't want to imply this is the way it's got to be. But for me, this is exactly what happened. The day that I went to Eddie's, and we got down and we prayed, and then I started reading this thing to him. And every time I get to one of those things I was really ashamed of, I'd read very quickly. And he'd let me go a little bit, and he'd stop. Okay, Jim, go back and read that again. I said, oh, God, he's going to throw me right out of his house on this one. I could just knew it. But it wasn't that way. He would share a similar experience that he'd encountered. And as we went on with this thing, what happened with me is that I sensed that it seemed like every emotion in the world was going, every thought was going through my head. I actually thought, am I going crazy here? What, you know, it was just rapid fire kind of thing. And when it was over with, what I noticed was something seemed very different. And what it was is I said I never felt comfortable in my own skin. I felt comfortable in my own skin, and it was a new feeling. I'd never had that before. I didn't even know how to recognize what that was. He had to point it out to me. And he said, go back home and get down on your knees and do six and seven, which I did. Now, some of the guys I sponsor know in my home group, I talk about six and seven because those two steps, in the big book, you got a couple of paragraphs. Those two have taught me much about who I am over the years. I look at character defects this way. The God of my understanding puts me on a short leash. If I get too full of myself and I'm out there, I can feel the leash being pulled back, saying, you've done it again. Come on back to the cage here. You know, just and step seven on my shortcomings, on trying to practice the spiritual principles behind these steps. Eight and nine, I did that. And I heard a lot of folks say, sometimes, you know, the monetary kind of, amends were easier to make. But it was some of those that... The one that was the toughest one for me to make was one of another chief that I had character assassinated. He was a good man. He didn't deserve that. And I didn't want to make those amends. And I had done everything except that one. And 2 or 3 months went by and saw my sponsor. And by this matter, they responded, Bill, I said, you really think I ought to go through with that? I don't want to hurt the guy's feelings. He said, you haven't done it yet, have you? I said, no, I thought maybe I ought to get back with you before I go ahead on this thing. He said, I'm not telling you what to do. He said, but I think you already know what you need to do. And I did. And I went and met with this man and told him what it was. And I remember him looking at me and he said, I never would have thought that out of you, Will. I thought, oh, man, this ain't going good. And plus, we'd rode to this restaurant in his truck. So I thought, oh, how am I going to get back to my own vehicle? You know, I'm messing this up. But then the next thing he says, man, he says, I don't know anything about alcoholics. Now. He was not a drunk. Good man, he was not a drunk. He said, I don't know much about Alcoholics Anonymous, but he said, what I do know is you're a different man standing here today than the guy that I knew at the end of your drinking. He said, you were dying then, man. He said, something's different. He said, whatever this stuff is doing, keep doing it. You know, it was basically what he said. I went ahead with 10, 11, 12. We often call about the maintenance steps, continuous inventory. Let me talk a little bit about this family that got put back together. All of us heal differently. And there's a chapter in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, two actually. One is to the wives and one is to the family afterwards. And I know early on, I didn't want to read those two chapters much at all. And if I did, I never took in much. But the longer I stayed sober, it began to make more and more sense to me. The damage I had not only damaged my wife, but also the emotional damage I'd done to our two children. And several years. I had been sober probably by then about 10 years, and my son, good size of a woman, my wife told me, she's, Jimmy's getting mad a lot and asking a lot of questions about whenever you left us those 7 months. This is 10 years later almost. And I says, what? She says, well, I don't know. He just, because he was 6 when I left. And he, so one night I see him looking over at me, and he says, he was just so angry, I could just see it. And Jimmy's a good-sized boy. And he said, why did you do it? I said, why did I do what? He says, why did you leave us? And I was stunned. I said, son, the only thing I could say is my drinking had got so bad that it wasn't anything your mom or you or your sister did. I just could not stop drinking, and it became the most important thing. I'm glad to say that those relationships were healed. And a friend of mine told me, he said, it's finally safe enough in your home, Jim, for that boy to ask the question he needs to ask without being fear of being screamed at or cussed at or something else, or you just not give an answer. And so every family heals differently because of this illness that we suffer from. The wife that had we or this when I told you I couldn't be there to take my wife to on our second child, I got a reprieve on that, and that came with my oldest grandchild. The night my daughter had him, I walked up and down the hallway with her because his dad wasn't there. And I was the first person to get to hold her. That was one of those things we don't talk a lot about. Some of those things, we get an opportunity to do it differently. Now, he's had his troubles as he's gotten older. He's 20 now. We just went to his son's birthday, Saturday, for his first birthday. So I got a great-grandson. I got 3 granddaughters that call me Papa, and they love me. And any one of those girls can call me, and I'm reaching for my wallet with a smile on my face. Someone asked me one time, they said, Jim, how would you define joy? I says, I was trying to figure it out. I said, well, happiness, you know. He says, no, what really brings you joy for... And then it dawned on me, I can be driving down the road and think about any one of my grandchildren and now this great-grandchild, and I can find myself automatically smiling. That's joy. And I never knew what joy was, never knew how to experience joy. This wife of 45 years has had some physical problems over the years. And through it all, she hangs in there. You know, she still stands her ground. Well, I told her some of that stubbornness coming out of Brooklyn, New York, too. She tells me, she says, a good thing I married you and got you out of Kansas. You still had them same old run-over cowboy boots you had on back then with whatever was on the bottom of them. She says, I felt so bad for you once. I was going to buy you a new pair. I said, there wasn't nothing wrong with them boots. I said, them were good boots. But some of the other things that have happened is I quit high school, like I said. I got my GED in Vietnam with my boat officer. I don't know, drinking Ham's beer, and I don't know if I passed or he just felt sorry for me. But either way, I got the certificate. Now, this part I've never talked much about until a few years ago when my sponsor finally asked me, he says, why don't you ever talk about your education? I says, I don't want to. I said, I don't feel comfortable. He says, look, if you were blowing your own horn, he said, I'd already said something to you about blowing your own horn. He said, but you don't ever know who's sitting in an audience that might need to hear something. He says, you just show up and do what you got to do. And bottom line, near the end of my military career, they found out a problem on my left hip, which was service-connected, and they were going to have to replace it, which meant my career was going to probably be over for the work I did. Long story short, Navy retrained me, but I was going to have to go back once I retired and get some other education to stay in that field. So I started plugging along, and I got an associate's, and then I eventually got a bachelor's, and I got a master's. And I've gotten licensed in 2 different states. That's not so much about me as it was someone never figured he was good enough or smart enough to do any of that stuff. Drinking, I couldn't have. But this, again, was a product of Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife and I were talking today about our family has had some pretty tough hits over the years. Sobriety doesn't mean we get a free ride. Life's still going to show up, and we've had some. Some of the folks that are closest to me know what some of those hits have been. One of them was enough to just rip our family apart. Daughter and son no longer will even communicate with one another. And this has been going on about 6 years now, but it just tore the family apart. My wife and I talking today, and we said, and she said it, she says, you know, with all the dark times we've had, we've always come through it. We're still here. She's wise way beyond what I ever expected to marry into. But today, you know, we want one another around. That's not what it was when I showed up here. The things that I do today is to try to stay involved in the fellowship. I sponsor men. I have a sponsor. I've always had a sponsor. I wouldn't want to try to do this deal on my own, because I'd still get pretty crazy between my own ears and nobody be close. And sometimes my sponsor and I talk about just getting current. Sometimes it's just to get with him and sit down and say, look, man, here's what's going on. I'm not looking for an answer. I just don't want to ruminate in my head anymore. And I was telling this in our home group a while back. Some of the guys I sponsor at my home group at night, and I says, I don't think there's a man in here that's invited me into their life to be their sponsor has said, here, Jim, run my life for me. Give me all my directions, and I'll take orders from you. And they all kind of laughed, you know, and some of them are sitting here at night, so I think they get the message, yeah, that isn't going to do it. But they didn't ask me to do that. We're on a spiritual journey together. I share what's been my experience, strength, and hope with the men I work with, and that's what my sponsor shares with me. I'd like to say I always do what my sponsor suggests, but I don't. And usually I'm pretty upfront with him now, so Steve, you know I'm not going to do that. So I don't even know why you're even saying that. But he does this other thing. He says, well, Jim, he says, I didn't figure you was ready to hear that yet. He says, and you might not want to try it, but he says, I thought I'd go ahead and put it out there. You know. But I have people today, the main thing that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me, besides the gift of sobriety, it's given me purpose. I never had a purpose. I was running aimlessly whenever I left Kansas way back when, and even before then. What you all have given me in here is truly a design for living. The gifts that come to me today by just showing up, hopefully to be of service to somebody else, to listen to the men that talk with me, and to give me the privilege to sponsor them. Knowing I have a sponsor that he's one human being that I can tell anything, and I know it will go to the grave before it would ever go any further. I just trust him that much. But he's earned that trust, and I hope the men that I sponsor can earn that. You know, because that's the greatest gift, too. As we get here, most of us are afraid. We don't trust people, and we sure don't want somebody getting up too close and finding out who we are. If you stick around here, for any of us, the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous have the keys that we need. Do we have to do them perfect? No. It says practice these principles. You know, it's just like, you know, anything else that we're going to do, you have to practice, and you have to keep practicing if you want to get better at it. And there's some days I feel really good about my spiritual development, and sometimes one of the guys I sponsor catch me on an off day. You know? Oh, you're falling off the mountaintop, huh? I says, well, it was hard, but I says, it was in trying to come up with an answer for you that I fell. I says, you know, but other than that, yeah, things are good. But I'm going to read this last thing, and I'm going to shut up and sit down. And it has to do with something we read at our home group at the close of every meeting. And it's one that, for me, speaks the truth. Some people say, well, it's the best home group. My home group's the best one for me. It may not be the best one for everyone else, but it's the best one for me that works for what I feel okay with. And this is the paragraph. It's on page 100. It says, both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. And I know that's a fact from experience. Thank you, folks.
Thought I was going to make it without crying. But I didn't. We're going to pass the baskets in accordance with the seventh tradition that every AA group ought to be self-supporting. We got other baskets going around? While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the other alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. We scheduled another event, like really close to this one. What were we thinking? But these flyers are out there. This is for May 9th and 10th. That's a Friday, May 9th, 10th. It will be in this room. Christy and Sammy are going to come down from Richmond and lead us through the 12 steps out of the big book. Again, it's a free event, no charge. Everybody's welcome. It's open. Take the flyers, talk it up. Please come out and join us for that. Are there any other AA-related announcements? Dave. Thank you. Danny. Thanks, Bo. What, Visky Pie isn't in the house? Nice and loud.
What?
Nice and loud. Woodtide Shopping Center?
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
From 2 to 4.
All right.
Also, there's a new meeting on Tuesday nights in Virginia Beach. It's off of Euclid Road. It's called Group of Drunks, and it's at 7 o'clock. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other announcements? Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining this home group, we're waiving the blood test this month. Just see any one of us, if you'll admit it now. Any one of us, home group members, please raise your hands. Thank you. And not to embarrass you, but just so we can welcome you, is there anybody in the room tonight in their first 30 days of sobriety? Just get your first name.
I'm Deanna.
Deanna, welcome.
I'm
welcome.
I'm Stephanie, I'm an alcoholic.
Stephanie, welcome.
No,
welcome.
My name's Zach.
Zach, welcome.
Patrick, how are you?
Patrick, welcome. Anybody else? We do have literature available, sort of attractively arranged up here. If you can fold it, it's free. Books have a nominal cost. Just see a home group member and we can arrange a purchase for that. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Anybody in the room willing to be a sponsor to another alcoholic, please raise your hand. Thank you. Can we thank Jim one more time, please? I'd like to thank everyone who participated, and after we we're not going to go to the restaurant now. We usually all go to eat after the meeting. These first two rows of three tables will stay. Those back four tables and their associated chairs will need to be stacked and rolled out of here. We'll appreciate all your help restoring this room to its original condition. And I'm just going to read the last two paragraphs on page 164 is our custom here. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Let's make a big circle.
Deliver us from evil, for thine is the kingdom.